Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
So, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, depending on where you are in the world. My name is Preeta, and I'm really excited to be your host this morning for our weekly Global Awaken Call. So today we're grateful to have a remarkable guest speaker with us, Laura Delano, whose personal journey is not only inspiring, but has had a tremendous impact on many people, and she's only just beginning. In a few minutes, our moderator, Rena Patel, will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker, Laura Delano. So this week's theme is about recovery from psychiatry and reclaiming inner compass. It's a really powerful theme, this idea of reclaiming our own connection with our own minds, our own bodies, our own spirits, and our own hearts, and moving away from the kind of diagnostic or pathologic labeling that can sometimes occur through our mainstream institutions, including medical and educational institutions. Our guest this week believes that it is imperative that we reclaim a sacred connection to our own inner compasses within the institutionalized spaces, especially our educational and mental health systems, that often teach us a false story that suffering, mental breakdown, and spiritual crises are medical conditions requiring professional and pharmacological treatments, as opposed to signs of aliveness, sensitivity, and spiritual connection to what's happening in our world that requires our attention. So we've asked, as a question of reflection, we've asked our audience to consider, when has distress and breakdown been a sign of awakening rather than an illness requiring suppression or treatment in your life? So we have the great pleasure of having Rena as our moderator today. With that, I'd love to just have you pass it on and introduce Laura and enter into deep dialogue with her, and then we'll rejoin up at the top of the hour.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Preeta. Let me just start by saying that it's such an honor to be able to moderate this call with Laura. Laura has just had a remarkable journey. She's a community organizer, psychiatric liberation writer, and activist who advocates for fully informed choice about psychiatric diagnosis and treatment for the individual's right to access alternatives to the mental health system. She recently founded and serves as the executive director of Inner Compass Initiative and ICI's The Withdrawal Project, which are launching this winter. She has spent the last several years working to advocate for those who are also lost in the mental health system. Most of her work is fueled by the 14 years she spent in the mental health system, and she's been on a journey to making this her life's work since 2010, when she chose to leave behind a mentally ill identity and the various treatments that came with it. So this is just a quick introduction, but as we go through the call, I'm just going to ask several questions, I think, that'll unwind Laura's journey and just the incredible transformations that have taken place. So Laura, I'll just start with asking, is there any specific way you'd like to introduce yourself to our audience? And then maybe we can just dive into the questions.
Thanks so much for having me here. It really is an honor. And hi, Rena, and hi, Preeta. I think your lead-in was great. And I don't know what else I could add because I think what you set out with was perfect. So we could probably just keep diving in.
Awesome. So I'm just gonna start by asking you, what does recovery mean to you?
Oh, that's a great question, and a big question. And I think my understanding of the word has definitely evolved over time. And so maybe I'll share what it means for me today, but touch a little bit on what it's meant for me over the past few years as it's changed. For me today, recovery, I think about the word not as recovering from a condition of some kind or from a state of unwellness or sickness. I think of the word recovery more as a process of reclaiming myself, of recovering myself from various stories and systems and institutions that I got lost in, really is how that word works for me. So I think in the past, I thought about recovery as this journey I was on to become normal. I having spent all of those years in the mental health system, I really came to see that the experiences I was having that got me into the mental health system, you know, these profoundly difficult emotional and mental struggles, because I'd seen them as these problems that needed to be fixed. I thought about, oh, recovery will be this end objective I get to when I feel happy and balanced and put together and I'm functioning well in society and I like fit right back into how I'm meant to be. But that has, that's changed as I've realized that those very ideas that I was carrying about recovery were actually keeping me trapped in many ways, and that if I really wanted to kind of recover my authentic self and recover a connection to the deepest parts of myself, I'd have to let go of this idea of normal and happy and whatever else, and really just reclaim like who I truly am, like pain and all. So I'd say that's how the word works for me today, and I use it in my website, Recovering from Psychiatry. So I use it in that way because I mean it's much broader than psychiatry that I feel like I've recovered myself from. But that's how it works for me at this point in my life.
Yeah, and I think many of us. And many in our audience will be able to really relate to that feeling or that expectation of being normal, and also going through that process of questioning what does it mean to be normal. Can you just taking a step back, can you take us through just the parts of your childhood and some of those experiences that really led up to your point of, you know, the catalyst that led up to you tapering off your medication and what led you to even coming into the mental health system? Because I'm sure a lot of our audience may not be familiar with that as well.
Sure. Yeah, do you think it makes the most sense to start with how I got into the mental health system first?
Yeah.
Do you think? Okay. Yeah, and so I was a child. I was 13 when I first met the mental health system, and I say the word met because it really was a kind of relationship that I was in for a long time. And the kind of kid I was prior to meeting the mental health system, was, you know, so I grew up in an upper middle class family. I had access to a lot of resources and privileges and opportunities, you know, all of my basic needs were met. I had, you know, nutritious food. I went to, you know, quote unquote, top private schools. I played sports. I was a well-respected kid. I kind of, on the surface, I met the criteria for, a full, rich childhood. And internally, so on the surface, I had this kind of, these various measurable things going for me. Like I did well in school and I was an accomplished athlete and this and that. But internally, I was a very sensitive and I see now like a child who was in the process of waking up, really. And I think I always felt a deep sense of connection to the world around me as far back as I can remember. You know, I have these vivid memories of like one memory in particular of just like going into the woods, actually right around this time of year, probably as the leaves were like vivid orange in the Northeast United States. And I just remember like lying down in the woods with in this big pile of leaves and like covering myself in the leaves and looking up at the trees and at the branches swaying in the wind and feeling the insects crawling in the leaves, like crawling on my skin, smelling the soil, hearing the wind, and just feeling this sense of oneness with everything and realizing just how much life there was around me. And so I think many, if not all, children are in touch with that level of awakeness. And so I kind of carried that with me into this very highly pressured environment where, yes, I had amazing opportunities given to me and I was afforded a lot, but I was also like very, very sensitive. And so what ended up happening, I think, was that the clash of this more superficial, observable realm of existence where, you know, I was in this top school where we were meant to study really hard and get straight A's and take honors classes and this and that, and then with my competitive sports and all of these things, I was operating at that level, but internally I was just feeling, I just felt the world so intensely. And so I think I began to struggle with keeping that integrated, and I ended up having a very profound experience at 13 that was what led me into the mental health system, where I was brushing my teeth one night, getting ready for bed, looking in the bathroom mirror, and I remember thinking about how I was, like, in the next day or the next couple of days, I was going to have to lead the middle school assembly because I was, like, president of the middle school, and I had all of these responsibilities on my plate. And I remember thinking about that, and then I just started to look into my eyes, and I just started to look deeper and deeper and deeper into the eyes and in my eyes in the mirror. And I began to, like, lose touch with my hands and my arms and my legs, and then I lost touch with my whole body, and then everything around me began to go black. And then I was just looking down this dark tunnel at this face in the mirror, and I suddenly realized this is a stranger, and I just had this encounter with this stranger looking back at me for I don't know how long, but I was terrified. And I see now I was having a profound, like, spiritual emergence of some kind. You know, I was like transcending self, and it, you know, it could have been this profoundly meaningful opportunity to, like, dive into what that meant. But I was 13. I was in this, like, highly pressured environment where everyone was put together all the time and, like, you know, high functioning and all of this and that. And suddenly, like, here I was, like, not understanding what was happening in the mirror. And the best I could do to make sense of it was, I must not have a real self. Like, I'm an actor performing this life, performing these grades, performing this, you know, being president, performing these, being, you know, being an athlete, but I don't have a real self. I'm fake. I'm a fraud. It was like the only way the only framework I could find to make sense of what had happened. And so I left the bathroom that night, like, convinced that I was a fraud and that I didn't have a real self and that I was trapped in this life of this stranger and I couldn't get out, because what was I going to do? How was I going to find my real self? I didn't even know who, you know, I wouldn't have known where to start. So I ended up continuing on pretending like everything was okay, but it was only a matter of time before, like, everything I was holding within me began to come out, and at home. So I would keep it together at school, but I'd come home and I began to explode into rages, and I'd yell and scream and curse, and I got physically aggressive with my family, and I, like, hated the world, and I just began to cut myself, and I began to think about death, and I just completely flipped, and it was like a Jekyll and Hyde transformation at home. And my parents, understandably, were just terrified. They didn't know what was happening to their eldest daughter. So they eventually did what most parents in American society are taught to do in these kinds of situations. They said, well, we're going to have to take Laura to a professional for help. Something's wrong with her and we want to help her. And so I met the mental health system at that point. I was sent to a therapist, and I remember feeling so betrayed because what I had come to see in that experience in the mirror and in the kind of the aftermath of that experience was that, yes, I was this fake performer, but the reason why I was performing was because of all of these powerful forces around me that had like brainwashed me into thinking I needed to be, you know, a highly accomplished kid in order to be worthy. So I kind of like, I had this critique of this, of society, while I also felt completely imprisoned in this fake life. And so to then be told, you're the problem, like you have to go to a therapist and get fixed because you're the problem. Like it felt, I know now, of course, that my parents were just doing the best they could, and, you know, from this place of love and concern. But at the time, I just took it as this profound insult. And so I didn't really get better, quote unquote. I continued to kind of have all of these issues. And so it wasn't too long before that therapist referred me to a psychiatrist who, in one appointment, so a span of 50 minutes, told me that my anger and rage were symptoms of mania, and my despair and the fact that I was cutting myself and thinking about death were symptoms of depression, and that I had bipolar disorder. And she then handed me two prescriptions for a mood stabilizer and an antidepressant, and like said, you know, have your mom call me to schedule an appointment for the next week. And so that was the beginning, really, of my life into kind of what I call mental patienthood. And at that point, I was 14. When I first saw a psychiatrist, I was 14. So that was how I met the mental health system, to try to keep going on and on, because there's so many layers to it. But that's it in a small of a nutshell as I can get it into.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing your journey. Wow. And we've spoken to you a number of times, because it took you until you were 27 years old, 14 years after these experiences, you know, to have these profound experiences that led you towards taping off your medication. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure, yeah. So by the time I'll keep it as brief as I can, but because it plays such an important role in how I ended up leaving the mental health system, I'll just quickly touch on kind of how things changed for me over the years that I really became deeply invested in thinking of myself as mentally ill. In high school, I rejected the diagnosis largely. So from like 14 to 17, 18, even though I had this bipolar diagnosis and I was told I needed to take these medications, something deep in me rebelled against it. But by the time I ended up going to Harvard University, because I was still stuck in this game, really, that I see now, it was this like game I was playing of performance. So I kept, even though I knew something, it didn't really mean, it didn't have a sense of meaning to me, I couldn't extricate myself from this game of performance. So I ended up finding myself at Harvard as a freshman in 2001. And I really, at that point, because I you know, had this last sense of hope that if I get to Harvard, maybe I'm wrong, and it really is just, I've got to get to this good college because it's what I've been taught is what you do with your life. And once I'm there, I'll feel happy and I'll feel okay and I won't want to die anymore and my life will make sense to me. But I got there and nothing changed. I still felt like a fraud. I still felt empty. I still didn't know who I was. I still wanted to die. And so that at that point, I became so overwhelmed with my emotional pain and my mental pain that I ended up, in a short matter of time, voluntarily going back to the mental health system, because I was convinced, you know, I've made it to Harvard. I've done everything I've meant to do, and I still want to die. That psychiatrist must have been right. There must be something wrong with me. I must be mentally ill. So from age 18 to age 27, that became my entire sense of self, was I am mentally ill. It's who I am. I have this mental illness that lives in my brain. It's a chemical imbalance. And that's why I have these mental and emotional experiences that I'm going through all the time, and that's why I have these intense highs and lows, and I feel emotions so deeply, and I can't integrate them, and I stay up late at night with my mind racing about the meaning of life, and, you know, what is space and time and language. And so I just, this framework of mental illness became how the sole way through which I made sense of who I was. And I became very good at becoming a patient, because this was the only framework that I had. And so I took my medications as prescribed, and I was this like diligent, you know, just diligent patient coming to therapy. I would check myself into the hospital whenever I was thinking about killing myself. It was like my career, really. I became a patient. And so simultaneously, even though I had invested all of this hope in, if I just do what the doctors tell me to do, maybe I'll feel happy one day. At the same time, my life just continued to fall more and more apart with each passing year of being this good patient. So I lost a lot of my physical health. I had chronic pain and headaches and like gut issues and weird things going on with my body. I like had cognitive struggles and I couldn't remember things, and my emotions were more out of control than ever before. But I was thinking about this all as like, oh, this is my mental illness. And in fact, all of these doctors I was seeing said, yes, you actually have treatment resistant mental illness, because, you know, you're getting all of this top treatment, but you keep getting worse. So you're just going to have to accept that your life, you may have once had all these dreams for yourself, but you're very mentally ill, and you might never be able to work or have a family or really take care of yourself. So that was what my life became. And I really, really fell deep down into this dark vortex of despair and hopelessness and alienation. And I eventually tried to take my own life because it was the most logical thing I could do. And I still to this day see my suicide as like the sacred thing that I made this choice to end my life, because it was not a life worth living. And I can see now that really what I wanted was change, but I just didn't know how else to change. So that's the kind of backdrop for what my life looked like leading up to 2010, when I ended up leaving the whole mental health system. And it's just important to say that because all of the awakenings and realizations and learnings that began to happen for me in 2010, really what they did was they helped me step out of that story I was telling myself of like, I am Laura Delano, I have treatment resistant mental illness, I'm never going to be able to be a full member of society because my brain is sick and I need this medicine and this is what my life is going to look like. In 2010, a series of events happened that forced me out of that story. And the first was basically being made to take a medication that I didn't want to take. I was in a hospital and they told me that I needed this particular psychiatric drug, and I didn't want to take it because of the side effects, but they made me take it anyways. And that really jolted something in me. I realized like, wait a minute, how do they have the right to do this to me? Because up till that point, I'd always said yes to everything. So I'd never had to have an encounter with a doctor that, had some conflict in it. So suddenly I was having this like encounter that where I realized like, wow, I don't actually have the right to say no here. And then the next event that happened was I was out of the hospital in a day program, and the psychiatrist got the sense that I was thinking about suicide, which I was. And he said, I'm sorry, I can't let you leave my office. You have to go back into the hospital. And I wasn't even against the idea, because I actually liked being in the hospital because it helped me feel safe for myself. But I wanted to be able to go home first to get my belongings, and he wouldn't let me leave. And I got kind of angry about that. And then he called security guards on me, and these big security guards came and they like escorted me to the unit, and they gave me the so-called choice of going voluntarily or involuntarily. And so that second experience also forced me to face the fact that this doctor had the right to strip me of my right to fresh air. And I had one other encounter that was a similar a similar kind of experience where a therapist called the police on me to do a wellness check, quote unquote, because I had slept through a therapy appointment. So I'd had these three encounters with really what I now see as force, the legally sanctioned and the socially and medically sanctioned right that clinical, licensed mental health professionals have to use force to make their patients do things that they don't want to do. And those led me up to what was my profound aha moment that really got me out of that story that I'd been living for so many years. And that was actually finding a book. I found a book by accident in a bookstore that had a really compelling cover. And that was the only reason why I bought it. I didn't even know what the book was about. It just had this head on it with all these different psychiatric drug names in the head. And I'd basically been on all of those medications. So I was like, oh, interesting. I've taken most of these meds. Like, I might as well get this book. And I see now that it was some, divine something that was at play here, because I was on five medications at the time. I hadn't read a book in a long time because I just cognitively couldn't absorb information. But I actually went back and read this book, and it blew my mind the book's name is Anatomy of an Epidemic, and the author is Robert Whitaker, and he's a science journalist. And basically, in a nutshell, this book explores the question of, why is it that in the United States over the last like 20 to 30 years that we've had this surge in all of these sophisticated psychiatric medications for all these different conditions? Why is it that rates of disability due to mental illness are actually skyrocketing? You would think the opposite would be happening. Because we have all of this new treatment, you'd think disability rates would go down, but it's actually the opposite. So this journalist set out to find the answer to that question. And what he found is that, in a nutshell, the story we've been told about psychiatric drugs by the pharmaceutical industry and by really the mental health industry more broadly is just not, it's very different. The truth is very different than what we've been told, because the science is actually telling us that long-term use of psychiatric drugs is actually making us sicker, like physically sicker, increasing rates of diabetes, obesity, like heart, liver problems, variety of physical things like cognitive, emotional, dysfunction, like social disability, inability to work. So I'm reading this book on five medications that I've been on for over a decade at this point, and it's all clicking. And I'm realizing the moment that I, that freshman year of college, when I really embraced being mentally ill and like taking medications for the rest of my life, that was the moment that my life really began to fall apart. And it all clicked. And I realized, what if it hasn't been treatment-resistant mental illness this whole time? What if it's been the treatment, in large part, that's been leading me to this point where suicide is the only logical solution to my life? And so that's what began, that's what ignited this fire in me of both hope and curiosity. Because I realized, if this story isn't true, this story that I need these medications for the rest of my life, if I don't have them, I'm going to die, I won't be able to function. If this story isn't true, then it means I might stand the chance at a different future. And then I began to wonder, well, what could that future be? And so this combination of hope and curiosity, even though I was terrified at the same time, that's really what began to propel me on this quest of self-education and of self-discovery. That's led me to where I am now, 7 years later. And oh my gosh, I am talking way too much. I really want to engage with you, so I'm going to stop talking at this point.
No, thank you so much. I think that the background that you provided is just so important, because what I hear from you is that, we met. So just as background, we had met at the Space Between Stories workshop that Charles Eisenstein holds about like two times a year, and it's just so fitting how we had met in this space, because in the Space Between Stories workshop, Charles talks about and what he writes a lot about in his work is that we're leaving this story where, you know, this old story where we're, where we play into fear and greed, you know, the story of separation, and how our world is moving into this awakening, this this awakening of consciousness, and how we're awakening to the interbeing and the interconnectedness and the collective of the world. And we're really, now we're starting to see this awakening happening. And, you know, we had explored these themes of a more beautiful world, our hearts, you know, as possible. And what I hear from you is that, you know, after these profound experiences, you really started to wake up to the more beautiful world that's possible, not just for your life, but also all of the things that that you can do, which is just, is just so incredible. And I feel like, you know, this journey, it took you to so many changes, and one of them was lifestyle changes. And those lifestyle changes led you to the founding of Inner Compass. And so a lot of these lifestyle changes kind of go back to listening to our bodies and the sacred process of taking care of our bodies, which indigenous culture is really, really paid attention to. You know, they paid attention to the rhythms of nature. And essentially your recovery process was very much going back to these rhythms of nature and taking care of oneself in a non-consumerist way. And so I'd love to hear from you in terms of how those lifestyle changes have really played a role in your life right now and the work that you're doing.
Sure, yeah, I'd love to share about that, because it's this idea of like taking care of oneself outside of the kind of consumerized like self-care industry is an idea that I got really fired up and excited about, because yeah, it's just played such a vital role in my own process. And I think it started the changes that I've made in my life definitely began within these stories I was telling myself, within the ideas that I was carrying about who I was, what my emotional and mental pain meant, what I should do with that pain, who and where I should turn to help me navigate that pain. It all really began there, and you know, because once I realized I'd been sold, not just told a false story, but sold a false story about psychiatric, like the safety and efficacy of psychiatric drugs, I realized, like, what other stories have I been carrying that aren't true? And I think the one that I eventually kind of evolved into was realizing that the story that if you experience mental and emotional pain, it means there's something wrong with you, and that you have to like modify yourself and change yourself to get rid of that pain in order to be acceptable again, or in order to like be normal, quote unquote. I realized, like, holy cow, this is really the story that's sitting at the heart of how I've lived my life, is this, you know, so many years of feeling such intense emotions that oftentimes hurt so much, and having such profoundly intense and oftentimes painful thoughts. You know, all of these years, I was just terrified of these aspects of myself. And I'd really bought into this idea of, like, I need to take these medicines to get rid of these emotions and thoughts, and I need to talk to these professionals, and I need to go to these hospitals and this and that. And I realized, like, if I'm going to reclaim myself, if I'm going to find out who I might be beyond the mental health system, I have to start listening to my pain. I have to start listening to these profoundly raw and agonizing and oftentimes like debilitating emotions that leave me like immobilized on the couch for 8 hours straight sometimes. Like, I have to listen to them. I have to walk through this fear I have of them. So it really began there, this lifestyle, this transformation of how I live my life. And once I began to do that, and it was terrifying, like, holy cow, nothing scared me more than being with myself in all my darkness, because I hadn't been with myself in that way in so long. And so, but once I started doing it, I began to listen. And I also began to to listen not just to my mind and my emotions, but to my body, because it all began to become clear to me that there's not this whole like mind body dualism thing. Like, that's just not how it really is. Like, I'm just, my whole being is this just as we are all interconnected more broadly on this planet. Like, my being is this interconnected being that I can't differentiate my body from my emotions, from my mind. And I began to really listen to my body and to see that, it was sitting at the heart of like, of my consciousness, really. It's the ways that how I was treating my body, and I was really harming my body. I came to see. I mean, I'd kind of been aware of that for a long time. I had many years of struggles with, what would be diagnosed as eating disorders today, though I don't use that language anymore. Many years of self-injury, like cutting myself, burning myself, many years of like really seeking profoundly self-destructive relief in alcohol and drugs. And I realized these injuries that I've caused to my body because I haven't ever learned how to be with myself. Like, I have to heal these injuries. And so that really, what that has looked like for me has been like hugely about nutrition and learning how to take care of my body through food and how to listen to what my body communicates to me about what I put in it, and not just with food, but even hair and skin products. Like, I remember back in probably like 2012, I kind of woke up to the whole, it isn't just the pharmaceutical industry that creates these products that can really harm us. It's like all of these different industries. And I began to look at the ingredients on, my shampoo bottle, and I'd be like, what the heck? This is like a carcinogenic, like gas product. Like, what is, and I've been putting this on my scalp, and the skin is our biggest organ, So I just began to realize all of these ways that my body had been so profoundly injured, oftentimes in the name of care, because, of course we get told, like, take care of yourself, buy this product, buy this skin lotion, buy this shampoo, buy this deodorant or whatever it is, and take care of yourself. And I just, the more I listened to my body, the more I realized I actually should basically stop listening to all of the advertising that's telling me how to take care of myself and like kind of do the opposite.
Yeah.
So, and I know you and I have talked about that in the past too, and that's been sounds like this has been a part of your journey too. And I know we're far from alone.
Yeah. What are the alternatives? I remember you telling me for your hair product, you use baking soda, but are there any other alternatives that you've been using?
Well, my favorite products, are baking soda, apple cider vinegar. Like, I'll use certain oils, like I love argan oil and coconut oil, and but it's pretty basic for me in terms of product. And it's like the same product I use to clean my kitchen, I use on my hair and my skin. I do love Dr. Bronner's also. Dr. Bronner's soap. I have no commercial relationship with them, I should say. I just really like their soap. But yeah, it's very simple. And that's what you come to realize, is that it doesn't take a lot to take care of, to kind of in a day-to-day way, take care of yourself, because you just get so indoctrinated into thinking you need to buy, and like have this, these cabinets of products to take care of yourself. Mm. And you realize, like, no, you don't.
Yeah. Wow. I feel like there's so many points where we can go from here, but I guess I'll just ask we had talked about some access points, and not just reclaiming our bodies, but being free of some of the constraints in our society. And I know one of these is definitely self-care, but are there any other access points that come to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I've come to see is that the way our much of American culture today constructs what we think of as education and learning. You know, I've come to see that, like, as someone who grew up in this, with access to this socioeconomic privilege, like, I grew up in this kind of quote-unquote elite education world where it was all about, like, how you performed in school and your test grades and your SAT scores so that you get into a good college, so that you get a good job, so that you could da-da-da-da-da. And, of course, I want to name that, like, my experience is a tiny sliver of, and, you know, that the perspective I come from with the socioeconomic race, like, you know, all of these different pieces. It's just one sliver, and, of course, many people didn't have this kind of experience with schooling and education. But I have come to see that so much of the way much of schooling seems to have evolved in our culture is that it trains you to become a passive recipient of information that really serves to turn you into a good producer and consumer, not necessarily a good critical thinker or a good activist or revolutionary. And so I think, yeah, beyond the psychiatric, pharmaceutical, mental health industries and the food industry and the self-care industry, I think it's also the education industry, and that we've really almost lost like a sense of meaning in learning, because it has become this performative process of like getting these certain milestones met so that you can feel like you've arrived in society. But like I see now, I look back and it's like, no wonder I felt so lost and ungrounded through my adolescence, because the way I was learning, it wasn't I didn't have meaning to it. It was about memorizing and regurgitation and grades. And so I think, I don't know, I'm really excited. The little that I know about homeschooling or like de-schooling, unschooling, I think that's another arena that is important for our society, for communities to make space for, is like, how can we create alternative spaces for young people to learn? And how can we reclaim learning from this idea of like grades and test scores and classrooms and all of that? That's been a big discovery for me, I would say, too.
Yeah. And moving away from, and definitely, yeah, in the space of education, but also in the space of healthcare and pharma, how has this played a role in the founding of Inner Compass, and where did that that idea to create a nonprofit, how did that arise?
Yeah, so the idea came, actually a friend of mine posed the idea to me. I mean, it had been a fantasy in the back of my mind for a long time that maybe one day I could be a part of, you know, founding an entity of some kind that could be a part of cultivating change. But yeah, just the world hadn't synced up in such a way that it had happened yet. And a friend of mine basically said one day, you know, I really believe in what you're doing. And this was a friend who had a foundation, and this friend said, like, we think you should start a nonprofit, and we want to support you. We want to help you get off the ground. So that's how it happened. I mean, it was this amazing gift. I mean, talk about a gift. This is someone who believed in me, who believed in the work that I've been doing, and who in the vision, this idea of what would it look like to build a society beyond the mental health system? How do we take our own personal experiences? Because I'm so far from alone, I should say. There's so many others out there who've been in the mental health system for many, many years, on medications for many, many years, who've realized, like, I don't know if this is who I want to be anymore, and they've made their way out. There's so many of us. And so, yeah, this amazing opportunity was presented to me a couple of years ago. And so that's what I've been working on with a few others. And our mission really, once we launch, we were meant to be launched by now, but such is life, we're soon to be launched. Our mission is really to help people get information and resources so that they can make more informed choices regarding all things mental health, because that's one thing I never had access to, was truly informed choices. Like, no one told me when I started psychiatric medications that they're studied on average 6 to 8 weeks before they're approved by the FDA, and yet we're told, take this for the rest of your life. Like, they've never actually been studied for long-term use, for long-term safety and efficacy, which is why we're finding that, you know, they are actually not safe and effective in the long term. You know, no one told me that. And that, so the so-called choice I made to take psychiatric medications, I don't think was really a true choice, because it wasn't informed. So we want to help people make more informed choices about the mental health system. And we want to help people connect with each other locally in their communities, so that, that people who realize, like, I want to find a different way forward beyond the mental health system, so that they, people can actually, at the grassroots, local level, like kitchen tables, coffee shops, park benches, like, can come together and begin to think about, like, how can we reclaim not just our own mental and emotional pain from this diagnostic framework, but also the right and the ability to take care of each other. Because I think that's another piece of the mental health system that has, I believe, like, really disempowered us, is this idea that you can only really help someone in a serious crisis if you're a trained professional. Like, the number of times I've heard someone say, oh, then my friend was suicidal, but I'm not a licensed mental health professional, so I said that they should go to the emergency room or they should call their therapist. You know, as human beings, we have a tremendous ability to be with each other in times of deep, deep, terrifying, confusing, scary distress, but we've lost touch with that. So we want to help people reclaim all of these different facets of what it means to be human. And a lot of this is also around helping people come off psychiatric drugs safely, because that's actually a very critical issue that, unfortunately, there's no research into. Doctors are not trained in how to help people safely taper, so they bring people off way too quickly, and then people have serious problems because these medications really change the structure of the central nervous system. So we have an entire website that we've built that helps people get information on how lay people have been tapering off safely and successfully, because we have this huge anecdotal evidence base of people who've kind of figured it out for themselves that you can't find in the research literature and the mental health system. So we want to help people get access to that information. So, and we're not anti-medication, I should say, at all. We believe that each of us is the only expert on ourselves, and we each have the right to make our own decisions about our bodies, but that choice, true choice, is only really possible if it's fully informed. So we want to help people get more informed.
Yeah. Wow. And so we have just a couple of minutes before we move into questions. But before, we had been talking about what it means to be women, having a conversation, listening to ourselves more deeply. And, you know, both just, you know, I guess regardless of gender, you know, there's this need in our society to listen to ourselves. But also as women, there's, you know, like falling into, you know, we often don't know the true side effects of a lot of the things that we're putting into our body, such as birth control could be one, antidepressants could be another more common one. And so I just want to leave our audience with some tangible points, you know, that we can really start making these changes in our lives today. So what, from your perspective, what are some of our options, and how can we start just making these little changes every single day to start kind of reclaiming ourselves and our own power and stepping into this place of really just love for ourselves and the rest of the world?
It's such a beautiful question. And I definitely won't even pretend to think I have any kind of concrete answer of, like, if people just do this, they'll figure it all out. And because, of course, I have no idea. Each person's path is their own path. But I would say, for me, what's been the critical first steps were beginning to ask questions. Like, really, I got to the point where I was questioning every belief that I was carrying about myself, about what it means to be human, about what I was being told by the media and by advertising and by the schools I went to. And so I would just say, question everything and get and unpack the layers beneath the beliefs that you carry, you know, say like, it's been so helpful for me to, you know, I'll come at a belief and I'll say, okay, where did I learn this belief? Like, who taught it to me? Where did they learn it from? Like, who actually kind of constructed this idea? Did they have profit to gain in constructing this idea? Like, where, you know, I question everything. So I would say, you know, being gentle with oneself and just fully allowing oneself to be wherever he or she or they are at is critical, and especially as women, like, you know, we are you know, talk about like being self-critical. Like, I just think we're just trained to be constantly critical of ourselves. So finding it's radical to me to just allow myself to be who I am, where I am, without needing to change myself. So starting there, just practicing allowing oneself to be exactly where one is, and then yeah, asking questions, digging into the stories that we tell ourselves about who we are, and not taking anything at face value, just like going on a quest for self, like this self-education quest. That's really what I've been on the last 7 years. And that's what then helped free up space for me to like learn how to listen to myself again is, yeah, these two pieces, like at the mental kind of intellectual level, like learning, teaching, educating myself, and then at the deeper, more somatic, spiritual level, like creating space to just like reconnect with myself again and reconnect with my inner compass. And that's why we named the organization Inner Compass, because this idea that, you know, we have the answers we need within us. Like, if we look within, if we feel within ourselves, there's this wisdom there that knows what we need. A lot of it's just this like kind of common sense level of knowing, but we get so trained into ignoring it. And so that's really what the journey has been for me but it's unique for everyone. It's unique. But I think questioning and making space to learn how to be with oneself, oh, those have been the two of the cornerstones, I would say, for me.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Laura, thank you so much. We already have a bunch of reflections, questions from people that have been listening through live stream, but I wanted to just remind people who are live on the phone, if you have a question, to press *6 and get into queue, or you can also send an email at ask@servicespace.org. In the meanwhile, before we jump into the questions that have already come in, I wanted to take the host prerogative and ask you a couple questions, Laura, if that's okay.
Sure.
Your story is so compelling, and you convey it so powerfully. It's pretty riveting. I wonder if you could. I was really curious about the process of recovery, and I think you started touching a little bit about this towards the end of your conversation about how it's important to go slowly. To you know, that there are kind of methodologies to start weaning yourself off medications. And it sounds like, just to understand your process, if I understood you right, it sounds like it started initially with just kind of, as you said, your body, like really just leaning into your emotions and being comfortable, you know, if it took not 8 hours lying on the couch and just feeling all that you were feeling and feeling your pain. And then that kind of slowly led you towards some lifestyle changes. I'm just wondering if you could talk about the kind of weaning process in yeah. terms of the medications on this, and also the reactions of the mental health system. I mean, these systems don't let go easily. Like, what were your physician's responses to all of this?
Yeah, thanks so much for asking these questions, Preeta. They're so, yeah, and the tapering question is especially so important. I always try to, whenever anyone asks me, like, what did it look like as you came off and healed? So I always try to start by saying that I was basically afforded, like, I just have such deep gratitude for all of the gifts and resources and privileges that I had access to as I came off, because not everyone has, you know, basically I was able to live with my extended family, so I didn't have to work and I didn't have to pay bills, and I had access to nutritious food, and so I didn't have children to take care of. I didn't have, you know, I was in this like optimal situation that I think is really important to name. That being said, I have many friends who've come off successfully, they've come off medication successfully without those things, so it's not like a necessity, but it always just feels important to name that. And yeah, basically, so the way I came off medications is not not a way that I ever recommend to people. I came off very, very, very quickly because I didn't have access to any information on how to do it safely. And my psychiatrist and my whole treatment team, they were not only like totally unsupportive of the idea, but I can see now they, like, my psychiatrist didn't know what he was doing either. So I came off 5 medications in 5 months, which is basically cold turkey. And just to kind of give a, to contextualize what slow and fast really look like, what we have found, there's this whole, when I say we, there's so many of us around the world who've come off medications and found each other largely online. So there's this kind of layperson withdrawal community online, in forums and groups and all that. What we have found is that the rate that most people, most of the time, who've been on these medications for like a few years or longer, what we found is that tapering between 5 and 10% per month of whatever your previous month's dose was, so that the cut amount each month is actually getting progressively smaller. That's a rate that many people find allows them to participate in their life pretty much full, like meaningfully, you know, along the way. Going faster, many people find, ends up causing disruptions that can be profound enough where people can't work anymore or take care of themselves. Like, and that was my experience. And I just happened to be lucky enough where I could basically be a mess for like 3 years and be taken care of in all these different ways. So if people are out there, just to know, like, there is a way that people are tapering off that allows them to continue working, to continue taking care of their families. It's just this slow rate. So a lot of people are tapering off over years. That's what it takes, because these medications are so powerful that the central nervous system really needs time to reacclimate to their growing absence. And actually, our website will have once we're live, I'm happy to share this information on the call, but right now it's behind a password. But all of this information, we have like a guide that we've written. It's like all there for free. Everything's freely available. It will all be there, because I can't go. I'm going to talk way too much and I want to get questions. But tapering, there is like a really careful methodology that people are using that's important to get informed about. Yeah. Oh, and just really quickly to say, the mental health system was not supportive of me at all. Like the people I was engaged with in 2010 as I was coming off medications, like, they thought I was crazy. Of course they did. But they couldn't make space to allow for this to be my truth. Like, it was, and so I ended up just leaving them because I didn't get emotional support from them. Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing. And what, just out of curiosity, are you also going to have kind of, as you taper off medicines, do you also suggest that people start experimenting with some of these positive lifestyle changes? And is that going to be part of your website as well?
Yeah, we have a huge section where we gathered, we crowdsourced tons of different kind of coping strategies for withdrawal symptoms and for just the whole process of kind of coming back into your body as you come off these medications, because many of us find you know, it's not just about getting the drugs out of our bodies. It's about coming back into our bodies and discovering once again, like, what it feels like to be in our skin and to feel our feelings that, you know, may have been suppressed or inhibited by the meds. So we have a huge section with tons of different resources that people have found helpful for that process. We have information on nutrition, on like exercise and kind of like moving the body, because it's such a variable experience. Like, people have, you know, some people find like intense rigorous exercise is like critical to their healing process, whereas other people find their body is so sensitized as they come off medications that walking up a flight of stairs sets off like a fight or flight response. So, and some people find eating like a high fat, heavy meat diet is vital, whereas others find raw vegan is vital. So there are many different, like, everyone's, there are just so many variables at play that there is no one way through it. But our website will have all of this kind of information there for people, along with actually a connecting platform that we've built for people who are thinking about coming off medications or in the process of coming off. You can actually like register a profile and then like find other people in your local community to connect and provide mutual support to one another around the process of coming off.
Thank you so much. So I'm going to get into some of the questions and comments. We've had a really rich web conversation going on while you've been speaking.
Great.
So Linda writes in this. She says that my daughter is a high achiever in a small liberal arts college where the health center and the general environment is very pro-meds for dealing with anxiety, stress, etc. I've tried to convince her to try all the alternative methods for a long time now, but her school counselor continues to advise her, and she believes as well that she should be on meds to help with the pain she experiences from anxiety. She pushes herself like crazy, doesn't sleep enough, exercise enough, etc., but it's a lifestyle she chooses. At this point, I have to let her do her journey. She knows all the alternatives as I've shared them with her endlessly, and she's gone back on meds for the second time. Any suggestions for a concerned parent who has to let go in this area?
Oh, yeah, man, that's a really tough spot to be in and an important question. And Linda, I mean, it sounds like Linda's really just bearing witness in a really, in a wonderful way, because it is the case that, I mean, when I was like deeply invested in this idea that I needed meds and that I was, the reason why I was having these experiences was because my brain was sick. Yeah, there was no reaching me by those around me. Not that I don't think people were necessarily awake to the problems with the medications at the time, but even if they were, I wouldn't have been ready to hear that message. And if anything, you know, if like someone, a concerned friend or family member came up and said, you know, maybe these medications are actually causing you some problems, I may have even like cut off ties with them and gone deeper into the mental health system as a result. And so I think it sounds like Linda's doing a really good job of just bearing witness, being there, like making sure that the information and resources are available and accessible, but not being, they're not being pushed, but they're there and they're visible if and when her daughter's ready for them. But yeah, I think I often say to parents who ask me these kinds of questions that yes, it is about bearing witness, making space, allowing their kid to go on their own journey, but getting curious, like when there is a chance to engage in a conversation about these deep questions of like, what does anxiety feel like in your body? Or like, what, you know, have you ever wondered about, you know, why the school system is set up in this way? Or just even these kind of open-ended, curious questions shared from a place of like love and compassion, I think can create, can oftentimes like spark new ideas within that person who might be deeply invested in that story. So just whenever there's like a subtle moment, if you have these kinds of deeper questions of like this anxiety you feel, you know, like where do you think it comes from? Or what do you think? Yeah. You know, those kinds of curious questions might end up going somewhere. You don't know, but just being there, being available and getting as informed as possible as you can yourself So reading books like Anatomy of an Epidemic, there are tons of different books. I can share them for sure with people. But the more informed you are as a supporter, the better able you'll be able to, yeah, the better resource you'll be for that person if and when they're ready. So,
that's
yeah,
awesome.
It's a tough spot, though.
Yeah, and also I would just add, I know Laura has some beautiful YouTube videos where she kind of talks about her own story, and we've linked to them on her bio page of the Awaken Call. So maybe even just, you know, if there's an open opportunity to sharing those videos or stories of Laura's experiences, maybe that would slowly trigger some thoughts in someone. So we have a question from Washington, D.C., and I think you kind of answered this as you went further in the conversation, where you said you're certainly not anti-medication, but more free choice. But this person asks or says the following: I practiced meditation for almost a decade, and all of a sudden I fell sick and diagnosed with bipolar disease in my 40s. I was not able to continue my meditation practice after that for many reasons. With medical intervention and with the support of family and friends, I'm leading a normal and productive life now. I tried to stop medication a couple of times, but fell back sick. I believe now that medications are inevitable if I want to lead a productive life. Isn't leading a productive life the goal of any life? If taking medication helps one with that, then what is wrong in living on medication?
Yes, I'm so glad that someone raised this. And I think some of my closest friends take medications and live lives that are meaningful and purposeful for them, and so I think it sounds like this person has found a path that totally is working for them, and that's great. And that's to me, it's about, you know, at the end of the day, human beings have been altering their consciousness with psychoactive chemicals forever, like the history of our species forever. And so this idea of like, oh, being, I'm pro medication or anti medication, it doesn't make sense to me, because, like, you know, I drink black tea in the morning that has caffeine, or, you know, I'll eat sugar sometimes and that has psychoactive properties, and people drink alcohol before they go to a party to relax. Like, so this idea of moralizing this, I think, is just, it doesn't make sense. And of course it just alienates. So for me, it is about getting informed. And if a person is being told, like when I was told, Laura, this is medicine that's going to alter the chemicals in your brain that are out of balance, that's actually a false story. There's no evidence to support that claim. This has been known for many decades. The National Institute of Mental Health has completely stated, you know, there's, like, we don't yet know what causes mental illness. Like, it's not a radical statement to say that there's no such thing as a chemical imbalance. And yet we're told that. So if someone is told that, when I was told that, I was not making an informed choice about the medications. But if I was told instead, you know, this is a psychoactive chemical that's going to alter your central nervous system in a way that might feel helpful to you. And just as, you know, drinking a cup of coffee helps someone feel awake in the morning sometimes, or drinking a glass of wine before a party helps someone feel more relaxed, this drug might do X, Y, and Z. But this is what's known about it. This is what the evidence for its safety and efficacy is. And we don't know what it's going to do in the long term because it's never been studied. You know, that to me is the kind of thing that will allow someone to make a more informed choice. So that's what I believe in, that people have the right make informed choices. And the last thing I'll say is that it's very common for people who've been on medications for a while to say, I've tried to come off and I relapsed and things got really bad, and therefore I need to take medications for the rest of my life because that's my underlying condition coming back. The reality is, I have yet to meet a person who has not tried to come off medications far too quickly. You know, who's ended up having these problems. Like, there's so little known about how to safely come off that people will try to come off over a period of days, weeks, months, and things go really south. And then they're told this is a relapse of your illness, but it's actually withdrawal. It's actually withdrawal symptoms that can last months or even years if someone comes off too quickly. So I would just put that out there that sometimes people will say, I've tried to come off and it went horribly, therefore I need them for the rest of my life. Like, that's a story we're told by the mental health system, but there's actually a different story that could be true, which is your central nervous system was going through a serious disturbance because of the removal of this drug. But if a taper was done more slowly, it might look very different. So, yeah.
Great. Great. We have a number of other questions on the web.
Oh, sorry,
but we also have
speak less quickly.
No,
I mean,
no,
less,
no, no. No, please. Yeah, no, this is great. I just wanted to, we have a live caller, so I wanted to go to that next.
Oh, great.
Great. Go ahead. Okay. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. This is Kozo from Cupertino, and thank you so much for your journey and what you're bringing into this world. I think I was listening to another Awakened Call just the other day, and it's from Dr. Bill Stewart, sorry, and he said something like 70% of the population suffers from depression. They just don't know it, you know, and and so I think you're bringing medicine to not just – it's interesting. You're bringing medicine of not relying on pharmaceutical medicine to so many people who they don't even know that they don't know. So it's a beautiful journey. Thank you.
Thank you.
The question – oh, no problem. The question I wanted to ask you is – so, you know, like you said, you weren't allowed an informed choice – right? So you were allowed a choice, but you weren't given all the information about the different testings and about the efficacy and the effects of these drugs in the long term and stuff like that. And so if that happened to me, I would feel almost a sense of betrayal or a sense of, I definitely feel some anger probably at the system that kind of duped me, you know, but I don't sense that in you. I sense in you, like, you embrace it all. Like, you know, your answer to the last question of, you know, we've been taking substances that alter our consciousness for humanity. And I sense this just openness to everything in you, you know. It's not like you're anti this or you have to do it this way, but I sense it's openness to everything. And I'm wondering, how did you come to that state of being where you don't have that anger and resentment towards psychiatric medicine that you're able to embrace it all?
Thank you. So it's Kozo?
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah, thank you so much, Kozo, for your comment and your question. And I'm sitting here with a smile on my face because as you were asking the question, I was just thinking back to the past 7 years and the journey I've been on through that anger, because holy cow, I still have anger. I should, as I'll say in a moment, I do still carry anger today, but earlier when I first kind of woke up and realized, yes, I've been betrayed, and that word nails it. It is a betrayal. I mean, I do believe that we are being, at a personal and collective level, we've been betrayed by not just the pharmaceutical industry and the kind of like mental health psychiatric industry, but all of these industries, we have been betrayed. And so I think, when I first woke up to that, and I woke up to the fact that the most formative years of my life, my teenage and 20 something years, where like I had lost so much that I didn't even realize I'd lost, you know, right down to, because these are the years you figure out who you are. And all I was mentally ill during those years. And then, you know, even losing, like, I lost my creativity and my cognitive abilities, my sexuality, like the most these critical elements of who you are and of how you learn how to navigate in the world. I didn't have connection to them during these years. So I went through a phase of pure anger I was so overwhelmed by it, because it was such a new it was such an authentic anger that I hadn't felt until since basically back when I was 13. And I was like angry at society for like making me be this, you know, thinking I needed to be this high performing kid. I hadn't felt anger at that level in so long. And it did come out in these, like, what I now see as more toxic, kind of destructive ways, where I thought about things in this us and them way. And if you had anything to do with the mental health system, I don't want to come near you. And it's the, they're bad and good and this and that. And I think I needed to be there for a while because I was grieving. I was grieving all of those losses, the loss of my physical health and all of these things that I'd lost. I needed to be there, but I eventually came to realize, and it took a few years, that being trapped, that the rage and kind of like self-victimization that I was living each day was its own kind of emotional prison. And if I really wanted to free myself from the mental health system, I had to let go of it. And I also came to see that this is not about bad people. Like people go into the mental health system to work because they want to help people. And so I eventually came to see that just as I had been betrayed as a patient, doctors and therapists are betrayed as well. Because, for example, the medical textbooks that young doctors in medical school are taught from are often written by the pharmaceutical industry. Continuing education trainings are funded by the pharmaceutical industry. So the whole body of knowledge that mental health professionals are you know, taught is itself a betrayal. So I eventually came to see we're all in this together. This is not an us and them thing. And that's what really helped me let go of a lot of it. But I do feel anger every day because I lose friends. I lose friends all often. Friends who die from physical health conditions caused by long-term use of psychiatric drugs, friends who are dying by suicide because they come off medications too quickly without realizing how dangerous it is, and then their lives fall apart and they don't get the support they need and they give up hope. Like, and I feel this anger, but because I also feel this profound love for life that I didn't feel. Over all those years I was on meds, I'm able to now kind of like channel my anger into my work and my activism and my writing, and it doesn't feel toxic to me anymore. But yeah, I really appreciate the question, because I think anger is a very important emotion. It's like in and of itself, it's not like a quote unquote good or bad thing, but it's like what we do with it that I think can be constructive or destructive. At least that's what I've realized for myself.
Beautiful. Great. And I just wanted to just notice that, like, you know, like you said, there was a certain time when you're on these medications where you weren't feeling. So it's interesting that pure anger that brought you back into your body, right? And brought you back into the world of feeling. And so, So it almost makes me happy that you still get angry now, because that means you're still in your body, you're still feeling, as opposed to numb or as opposed to,
totally.
You know, I mean, if you know, your friend dies of suicide or whatever, and you don't have that feeling, then what's the purpose of living, you know? And so
totally.
That's beautiful.
Totally. Thank you. I mean, and that to me is the message at the heart of all of this, is that, like, this idea that they're like quote unquote bad emotions, whether it's despair and sadness or anger, whatever it is, like, or anxiety, like that's a story we've been told, but at the heart of it, we feel these things for meaningful reasons. Like, and we, I think are the darkest, the dark, painful, raw, scary stuff that we feel, like it's a message. It's conveying a message about the world we live in. And I think, like, this idea of like 70% of the population has depression, they don't even realize it. Like, you know, for me personally, I would set aside the medical language to that, but it's like we are in a crisis of despair and hopelessness and isolation at epidemic levels. And that's a message to us, like, about our world. Like, and we need to start listening to our pain, because it's telling us that what's happening to our environment, what's happening to marginalized peoples, there's so much happening, pain happening in our world that we're feeling in our bodies. We're carrying that. Like, I feel like we are just channeling this bigger pain, and we have to feel it in our bodies so that we can turn it into fuel to cultivate a different future for our society. Like, our pain, we have to stop pathologizing. I mean, I don't want to say we have to stop. That sounds so demanding. But I really feel like we have to stop. If we stop pathologizing our most painful emotions, like, they are going to become the most effective fuel to build and cultivate, like, a more interconnected, loving future. They're telling us really important things.
Thank you so much, Laura. I want to read to you just a couple of reflections that have come in, because your talk has obviously really inspired people. And then, if we have time, go to a couple more questions that have come in on the web. So Nan writes in that, "I'm so happy to hear your family gave you the time and space to heal. My family never did. I spent my entire life seeking in one way or another, sometimes negative, sometimes positive. Ironically, I'm in the elementary education field. Sadly to say, these environments have a toxicity to them. You are often questioning your own gut instinct to situations. Your statement about medical conditions requiring professional and pharmacological treatments as opposed to signs of aliveness, sensitivity, and spiritual connection to what's happening in our world that requires our attention. It brought tears to my eyes. So true indeed." So some appreciation there from Nan. David writes in that we all get caught in some kind of brainwashing, trusting some authority, be it called medicine or religion or education or military, rather than trusting ourselves. Congratulations on finding your way and yourself and your own truth. I suppose distress and breakdown has always been a sign of awakening in my life, including before I knew it. I was distressed because I was trying to comply with what didn't fit me. My breaking down was also my breaking up and out. Distress and breakdown has always also been my awakening, though I often didn't know it. Medicine is that which heals. When treatments and drugs don't heal, they're not really medicine. It's taken some awakening to realize that. So thank you.
Beautiful.
And then I want to, let's see, somebody writes in from Naperville, question says, how does one, living with an inner compass, exist in a world of Affordable Care Act and insurance?
Oh.
You know, yeah, as much as you feel like answering about that, that's a big question.
No, it's an important, another important question. Yeah, I mean, there's so many layers to that, like, I guess the access point I'll make to that question, because I'll leave aside all the kind of, like, political issues with our healthcare, quote-unquote, care system, or illness management system, maybe is a better way to put it. But I think, and I'll just speak about my own experience. Like, I used to think that taking care of myself meant going to doctors. Like, I equated those two things. Like, oh, if you take care of yourself by, like, visiting doctors and taking medications, and that's how you take care of yourself. And I've really come to question that in, like, all these other arenas of my life beyond just, like, mental health, quote unquote, you know, like, headaches, body issues, thyroid problems, gut problems. Like, I've found that my own way to healing, a lot of it has happened by, like, actually extricating myself from doctors, from allopathic doctors within the healthcare system. But that's just my own experience. And of course, people are in very different positions and very different circumstances. And it's easy for me to say that because I've been able to reverse some of the health conditions I've had. Like, I've had autoimmune problems and thyroid problems and gut problems and things I've been able to reverse them without doctors. Like, I'm not saying everyone can and should, but that there are ways right outside of the healthcare system as well, is all I'll say.
Great. And you had earlier in your conversation alluded to the, you know, relative privilege in which you grew up. And I know from other contexts of hearing from you, you address a lot kind of the extra issues that people that have less economic means and, you know, maybe different socioeconomic backgrounds might face. I wonder if you just want to, if you care to just touch on that a tiny bit before we close.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a critical, like, my this journey has, and thinking about how much privilege I've had access to has left me just every day almost overwhelmed by the realization that just how many people don't have access to what they need and are having things done to them that are just such profound violations of their being. And just that this is like this, it's just so big. Like, we have so far, I mean, there's just so much work to do around this. But what I guess all I'll say to just try to keep it brief is that I think it's really important to politicize our personal experiences, like that, I can't remember who said it, but this idea of like the personal is political, and that people who are living in poverty, who are being discriminated against because of the color of their skin or their gender or all of these different ways that marginalized people are harmed and alienated in our society, the suffering and despair and angst and pain and the oftentimes the physical health issues that are happening in these people's lives, like these are political. Like, it's political. It's not about, oh, there's something wrong with you individually and you just like need to get access to treatment so that you can go fix it. Like, this is your body, your mind, your consciousness is channeling this bigger structural, systemic, like these forces that are so degrading and dehumanizing and oppressive to so many people. And so I think just even starting there by recognizing that the pain and the difficulty that one goes through is not caused by what's happening inside of them. It's caused by the world around them and their relationship to it. That doesn't necessarily change anything in the moment, but I found that it can help, ignite a sense of like power and agency, and that it isn't me. I'm not defective. Like, I'm actually awake and in touch with the world, and that can then lead somewhere else. I mean, that's a very limited answer to such a profoundly important question. But it's just a starting point, I would say.
Well, great. Laura, this has been such an incredibly, illuminating conversation and inspiring conversation. And you're such a beautiful person to articulate your story and to share in such a deep way. I guess the final question we always ask our guests is there something that we as a kind of global ecosystem of people focused on the idea of change yourself, change the world? Is there something we can do to support your work, your important work in the world?
Well, I guess maybe I'll leave everyone just with the website. I mean, I'm so eager to connect with and hear from people out there who are interested in these ideas and in this idea of like building a future beyond the mental health system. And we're in this weird limbo area where our website is all up there on the internet, but it's hidden behind a password. So maybe what I can do is leave people with the URL and then and my contact information, and then please get in touch with me if you want to stay in the loop so that once we launch, I can let you know, or if you're interested in being involved, because a lot of what we're going to be doing will be around like local grassroots organizing and helping support folks in their own communities to get things going. So if you're interested, you can email me at laura@theinnercompass.org. So Laura at the inner, INNER, compass, compass.org. And then our website is www.theinnercompass.org. And again, if you go there right now, you'll see a password protection page. But I'll keep you posted if you want to be kept in the loop once we take the wall down, which should be in the next couple of months. So
yeah, and we'll also
touch. Yeah.
We can also send out that information to everyone on the
call.
Oh,
cool.
And your
and
email
I just want to say thank you so much. I'm so honored to be on this call with and to just have the opportunity to share my story. And thank you so much, Preeta and Rena, for making space to be here with me. It really is an honor and a privilege.
Thank you again. Deep, deep gratitude to you, Laura, and for all of our listeners. Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you.
So much.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.